Oh my God, this is crazy. August 4th, 2011. Here, I was selling round trip JetBlue voucher, $280 or 60 bitcoins. And so that means $4 a coin. Oh my God. Why did you make me look at this?
Hello, welcome to episode 41 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell, and my guest today is Charlie Schrem. When I got into Bitcoin, the two ways I was most familiar with to buy Bitcoin were to wire money to Mt. Gox in Japan, or go to the local 7-Eleven to send cash to BitInstant. It's not hard to see why BitInstant became one of the biggest Bitcoin companies in the US until it stopped doing business in 2013. Charlie Schrem was BitInstant's CEO and co-founder. He was very active in the community, and I would guess most Bitcoiners see him as someone who took one for the team. Charlie served a two-year sentence for activities related to money laundering, lack of proper licensing, and not filing suspicious activity reports. Of course, many feel he was doing nothing morally wrong, and some argue the legal case wasn't that strong. Surely his prison sentence was an early warning shot to those running Bitcoin businesses. Now that Charlie Schrem has served his time, he's become active in the community again. In today's episode, Charlie and I discuss his early days in Bitcoin, BitInstant, his new MainStreet.ky venture, Steemit, the People's Bank of China's effect on Bitcoin, and more. Check out the show notes page for links to many things we discuss, including Charlie's Steemit series called A Geek in Prison. Just look for episode 41 at thebitcoingame.com. You can also comment on this episode there. Here's our interview. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I mean, I'm hoping to just talk to you about your real early days, maybe even before you got into Bitcoin, and kind of talk about your life and get to present day eventually.
Yeah, sounds good.
What were you doing, say, just before you first got interested in Bitcoin?
Before I got into Bitcoin, I had a startup, dailycheckout.com, which was like a deal of the day type of site where we sell one thing for 24 hours and we just try to blow it out. And doing that while I was in university. So I had that company that I work at during the day and then I go to school at night. And then I was in my senior year of college when I found out about Bitcoin. And that took up all my time. And I kind of got burnt out from my other startup. So I told my partner I want to sell the company. And we did that.
How did Bitcoin first make itself known to you?
I was in a lot of IRC rooms back then. Just always talking to people. And everyone had all these crazy concoctions that they made up or found out about. And so it was crazy to see that Bitcoin with something that someone was talking about. He's like, oh, download this program on bitcoin.org and I'll send you some Bitcoin. I'm like, well, it's just like PayPal. He's like, oh, there's no fees. I'm like, it's not worth anything. He's like, yeah, it's not the point. It's just really cool. And I looked into it. I said, yeah, this is really cool. There was no one who was like really interested in like buying it or trading it or anything like that. It wasn't like about that. It was more of like a bearer instrument, something that you can trade between one other person. And if they seem it has even like a penny value, then you can use it like to pay someone for something.
Did you have any interests or political leanings at that point that kind of had you prepped for something like Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'm an economics major. I studied, that's what I got my degree in. So I was always interested in you know, math and then socioeconomics and how we, you know, how our behavior affects the way we save money, spend money, what kind of social norms there are around it, what kind of macro or microeconomic situations, political, even like weather or psychological or emotional things can affect the way we spend, save, and use money. And then what the question of what is money the same time, and then things around that, I was always studying. So when I found out about Bitcoin, it was like the perfect fit because Bitcoin kind of took what I saw was years of Austrian economic theory and it applied it to like a reality. Because up until that point, like the Austrian school and the Chicago school of economics was more or less just something on paper, you know? So when Bitcoin came out, it took a lot of those theories and applied it to like real life. And that's what socioeconomics is essentially.
So after you got into Bitcoin, what were some of the first hands-on things you did related to Bitcoin?
I'm just talking to a lot of people and working kind of these, a lot of these theories through, meeting up with people in the Bitcoin in 2011, we had like a quasi Bitcoin conference in New York, and a lot of us met each other for the first time. But just transacting too, like transacting in Bitcoin, was a lot of fun.
Was there anything you did on a big level before BitInstant?
No, BitInstant was my first foray into like Bitcoin business. I was selling things on the Bitcoin Talk forums for Bitcoin. What I would do is I take products from my warehouse at Daily Checkout, my first company, and I just list them on the Bitcoin Talk forums, and I'd sell them for people, and they'd ship it out for me.
Interesting. Were you giving them a good premium or not really?
If there's a way for me to go see some of like my first listings, we could probably see like what I was charging.
Oh, are you looking them up?
Yeah, we were making good money.
Well, I'm sure now if you look at the Bitcoin, what you got for it, it would look really good.
Yeah, here it is. Here, look at this. I was selling JetBlue vouchers. So you get like a free, you get an airline ticket. You essentially get, I had vouchers I would buy on Craigslist, which were like one free round trip flight on JetBlue. And I'm looking now, it's a current price for a voucher was 19 Bitcoins.
Wow. And what was the date?
Oh my God, this is crazy. August 4th, 2011. Here, I was selling round trip JetBlue voucher, $280 or 60 Bitcoins. So that means $4 a coin. Oh my God. Why did you make me look at this?
Sorry. What's your handle on Bitcoin Talk?
It was Yankee.
Well, it'll be fun to look at some of what you were doing back in those days. So deciding to start BitInstant seems like a pretty big move. What kind of was going on to make that happen?
I was just browsing the forums one day, and my business partner had a really good idea, which was to start a service, be able to buy Bitcoin a lot easier. I was using Tradehill at the time, and it wasn't working out. Because every time I would send him money, like it would take a few days, and then the fees are a lot higher. If I wanted to use Mt. Gox, I didn't want to wire money to like Japan. So his idea was essentially we keep a reserve of money at like Mt. Gox or Tradehill, and people give us money in the U.S. and then we put money in their account in one of the exchanges. And it worked out really well because people in the U.S. had money. And they didn't want to send it over, but it took me like $200-$300 worth. So,
what were the different ways that you would accept money?
We had like cash deposits, and we had a deal with a company that enabled us to take payments at like 7-Eleven, CVS, Walgreens, Duane Reade. So you'd be able to like go to these locations and buy Bitcoin.
So I do remember sometimes people would say, "Oh, they're having an issue or whatever." Was that just volume? There were occasionally issues, or were there some hiccups along the way?
There was always issues. Like, I mean, we were running that thing from our basement, and it was very hard. I was the only employee at the time. And you know, within 1 year, we were doing like $100,000 a day in volume. So things were always going wrong. But I would say like 75% of the transfers would go through in 20 minutes. And then the other 25% would take a few hours at that. But we always honored the rate. So it always worked out. People were always happy. We were a startup out of our basement.
How long was BitInstant in business?
2011 to 2013. It was fun.
You weren't always by yourself in the basement, I assume?
No. We moved to, where did we go? We moved to the first office on 23rd Street in Manhattan. And that was when it was just a few of us. It was me, Eric Voorhees, Rachel, who is our head of services, and a few other people. We were renting half of an office from like a Broadway company that made like Broadway shows and stuff. So we rented out like half of it with them. And then we got really big. So we moved to a much bigger spot that cost way too much money. I think our rent was like $16,000 for or something stupid like that for like a huge, like a floor office. But we had the people. I think we had a staff of 30 people at one point.
Wow. What was...
It got crazy.
How many users did you guys have?
At least 100,000 users. I'll tell you, maybe not that much, but 75,000 maybe. I don't know exactly, but I'll tell you. At one point, we were doing almost $1 million a day. So about $30 million a month in volume. I mean, those were the early days of Bitcoin. TechCrunch did a report and said that we were 30% of all the volume. We had that much market share. We were 30% of it. It was crazy.
Were you having concerns about know your customer issues at the beginning or at any point?
We always took customer data. We always had their customer name, address, phone number. And then when you actually had to go to like a 7-Eleven or a drugstore, you actually had to show ID because you were using like a Western Union location. So we were pretty good on the KYC and our limits were really low. So yeah, we always took care of that.
You were probably the biggest Bitcoin business in the United States at the time.
Yeah, we were definitely the first and the largest. I think it was us and BitPay were the biggest ones. And we worked very close together. We did a lot of OTC trades with each other. The coolest part was offering jobs to people and be able to, like, you know, give health insurance and stuff like that. That was the best part.
At the height of BitInstant, how old were you?
22, 21.
Did you talk about Bitcoin with your parents?
Yeah. My mother actually gave me the first like $10,000 to start the company, but they didn't understand it and they still don't understand it.
You sound like you were probably profitable pretty quickly, right? Or were you?
It's hard to say because we did a lot of like research and development. So whatever we put in, we'd always use for like research and development. So we were always even every day.
So you're really trying to grow the company, not just get some money out of it.
Yeah. We pay the salaries and then that's what we do.
Who were some of the big investors along the way?
Well, we had the Winklevoss twins, which are the famous ones.
I was familiar with them. Anybody else interesting or was that?
That's really it.
Did they do a lot of due diligence or were they just like, hey, this is the hottest Bitcoin company right now?
No, they did. They definitely did do a lot of due diligence. They were very involved.
I don't know if it was both of them or just one of them. And you what spoke at the San Jose Bitcoin conference in 2013?
Yeah.
And it just always seems like that's the conference that everyone says really like was the first real big conference.
Yeah, that was a real big conference. Yeah, that was a great conference too.
Should we talk about when things started to go wrong?
Sure. Although I won't talk about like my case or anything like that.
Okay.
You could ask, but there are some things that I just can't answer.
Did you have any signs before your arrest that something like this was in the works, perhaps?
No.
Just shock and incarceration?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, man. What was that experience like and what went through your mind?
It was pretty crazy experience. You don't believe it until you're just sitting in that jail cell that night. You're like, oh, shit, I'm in jail.
Do you want to talk about being in court at all, how that went?
Not really much to talk about there.
So you kind of had to plea bargain to get where you were, which was a 2-year sentence?
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked much about the experience of being in prison?
Yeah, I've been writing a series on Steemit. And I've been doing pretty well. I've been writing a series on Steemit.com about my experiences called a Geek in Prison.
So I guess you got out, what, about a year and a half? The sense, and was that pretty much something you expected, or was that a surprise, or
what, getting out?
Yeah, just getting out a little bit early.
Yeah, you don't know when you're gonna get out because there's like a whole process. You don't get out per se. You get transferred to like a halfway house, and then a halfway house is like you're still incarcerated, but then if you get a job, you get to like move home under like home confinement. So I did that, and I got a job at a restaurant. I worked as a dishwasher, and I was able to live at home. And I washed dishes.
What was it like in the halfway house for you? Was that okay or tough?
It was bad. It was tough in there. I mean, prison was better.
So then you get out, you get home, and you've moved to Florida. And do anything before starting the new business?
No, nothing really, just enjoying life.
So what were some of the first things you did to enjoy life?
Do a lot of hiking, a lot of swimming, and a lot of outdoorsy stuff. We did a little bit of traveling that we could, and just eating at restaurants and sleeping in my own bed.
What did you miss the most in prison?
My fiance.
Were you able to keep up with Bitcoin news and stuff at all in prison?
No, almost impossible. I got letters every day and emails from people, but the emails are really restricted and the letters are pretty much like letters, written letters, 3 days old, short. I had visits. A lot of people came to visit me too, which was really great.
Today's magic word is hold. H-O-L-D. Enter the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com. Your new business is called?
We're doing the first securitized blockchain asset. What we're doing is we have a portfolio of companies. Our website's mainstreet.ky, and we have a portfolio of companies that we're purchasing, and we're essentially tokenizing the shares of the portfolio company on the blockchain. So one token, one Main Street token, represents ownership in the company that owns all of the companies. And these are companies that have been, they're not venture capital, they're kind of middle market companies that have been around for a very long time. And what we do is we do distributions on the blockchain as well. So we pay out profits to the token holders on the blockchain, and we're doing this on Ethereum. It's a security, so because of SEC regulations, the token is actually closed to U.S. residents.
So it's basically for people outside of the United States to get some exposure?
It's for the Chinese investor, yeah.
And what are some of the bigger holdings in the company?
So our first company, we released a prospectus of the company. That we're purchasing is a sanitary waste business. This is a Michigan business. Been around for 23 years, mom and pop. They septic tank pumping and waste management. They're pretty healthy profit margins, 30% profit, I think, last year. And as long as everything keeps running the same, we should be able to take those profits and distribute them to the token holders.
How many other companies are in this basket of companies?
The second company is a manufacturing development company. They pretty much develop when you have an invention or a really intricate minimum viable product that you need to build before you mass produce it, they do that for you. So they're a very specialized manufacturing development company that creates minimum viable products and help engineers, architects, and manufacturers design a product before they have to mass produce them. And they have a factory, they have all the people, they have all the assets, and they've been around also, I think, like 15 years, also in Michigan.
So I guess people are also trusting you guys are picking good companies and...
Yeah, I mean, we're not like the Dow where anyone could be like a fund manager and do it themselves. That's, I'm not a private equity guy, but my CEO, Jason Granger, comes from the private equity world. He's negotiated a lot of deals and merger acquisitions with AIG and other companies like that. It's what he's done. It's what his family does. We're a private equity company that's putting our companies on the blockchain. That's what we're doing. I am the CTO. I do the tech side of things.
What is your technical background?
I have a degree in economics and math. But I did learn programming when I was in high school, so I do Java and Python. But I don't really code for like trade. But I do oversee and supervise the development process, and I will have to write a script here or there. But there are a lot of much better developers than me.
I guess you guys identified that there were people just looking for this kind of a product, or who are your customers really?
Customers are pretty much China and the international community that wants to have access to the U.S. market.
And is that very difficult right now?
Yes and no. There doesn't really exist like an ability for someone to do that. The blockchain kind of offers a bridge for someone who's outside of the U.S. to be able to buy into the U.S. market. That's what I would say. That's pretty much what it comes down to. So doing that and being able to have a liquid asset that trades on exchanges, it makes investors a lot easier knowing that they can buy and sell these assets at will. So it doesn't really exist in today's world. Like if you're a Chinese citizen and you want to buy an American private company, that's unheard of. It doesn't exist.
How is blockchain the key? I'm not sure I'm seeing what the magic is in the blockchain to make that work for you.
Putting assets on the blockchain is something that I've always wanted to do, and many people want to do it. Being able to trade you know, a share of your home for a share of someone else's home, or being able to trade your home with someone else just by trading a token, or business, or being able, if you're a stockholder at a company and you get paid in shares too, in addition to dollars or hopefully Bitcoin, and then you can sell those shares of your company to someone else who works for Coca-Cola. I mean, that ability to do that is just going to break down barriers. It's peer-to-peer secondary markets. It's unbelievable. So we're taking the first step here. We're putting companies on the blockchain. That's where the magic is. It's the ability for some people to trade from person to person a token that represents ownership and real physical assets.
I guess I'm just trying to understand, making sure you guys are compliant with laws.
Again, we're closed to the U.S. market. If you're a U.S. citizen, you can't buy the token. You have no ownership or distribution rights whatsoever.
But if it's freely traded on the blockchain, does that matter?
Well, yeah, it does. Because again, if you're a U.S. citizen and you buy the token, it doesn't mean anything for you. The token represents no ownership for you if you're a U.S. citizen. You don't have the rights. You won't get distributions. You won't get the rights of the token gets you. And frankly, you shouldn't be owning that. The person who sold it to you loses out as well.
Okay, so you guys will always need to see someone's KYC information before they'll earn any benefit from the token.
When they buy the token, yeah. And then distributions are done by the exchanges too.
Okay. So in theory, someone could wrongly sell it to someone in the U.S. and they could wrongly sell it back if it appreciated a bunch, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know a lot of people I've heard express, they're just worried you're doing something that are going to get you in trouble again. But I assume you're being really careful with what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Are you guys still kind of setting it up, or?
The token sales in 2 weeks on January 23rd. And yeah, ready to go.
Is it all about residency? Say someone lived in another country but was a U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, it is. It's the same thing as if you own or work for a company that's non-U.S. based, even though you're a U.S. Resident, the company could buy the tokens.
Are there any specific risks you think are involved in buying this token?
Well, there are a lot of risks involved you're buying a token that represents speculative assets. So it's the same risk associated with buying anything, really.
So similar to buying a stock in a company, would you say?
Yeah. These are private companies, though.
Their books aren't quite as public as that.
Yeah, we're making everything public, though. We're following the same standards.
As a company that would be listed?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
We have a big four accounting firm that's going to be doing all the financial statements and auditing. And they're going to be figuring out what the distribution numbers are. And it's all third party.
What are your hopes as far as how this will go? What are your kind of projections or guesses?
Yeah, we're looking to raise $25 million. And we'll easily get there. And to be able to provide a proof of concept for this, because we already have a pipeline of companies that we've put together. So we're going to be able to allocate those funds and be able to have a whole portfolio by the end of the year. And it's going to be really awesome for the token holder, because now your tokens are ownership in a bunch of different companies that are making profit for you.
What was the reasoning for going with Ethereum blockchain rather than the Bitcoin blockchain?
There's no way to do it on the Bitcoin blockchain. There's no smart contract solution that works right now.
Okay, technical limitations and, mm-hmm. and that.
Although I want to. I mean, I like Rootstock, and we're playing with Rootstock, but they're not ready yet.
Got it. So you believe in Ethereum pretty darn strongly, I guess, then, that it's here for the long term?
Not necessarily, but it works right now.
Okay. It's not the kind of a thing where you couldn't port this.
You can easily port it. Yeah. That's what we'll probably end up doing when a better solution comes.
And what do you think the better solution will be? Rootstock, or is that what you're looking toward?
Yeah, I really like Rootstock. It's pretty awesome.
Do you want to talk about other crypto projects that you're interested in?
Well, I've been playing a lot with Steam. I really like that project. So it's been really a cool project.
There's some people who are not impressed with Steam. I can see if you use Steam and you're a big name like you, you probably earn a lot from Steam, earn a lot of Steam.
Yeah.
What else do you like about it, though, besides that you're probably earning Steam?
I don't really post anymore and make a lot. I made a lot of money in Steam, but the price has gone down. I think it's a really cool application for the blockchain, social media on the blockchain. And frankly, the people that have the naysayers don't really know much about it. It's a huge lack of education. Steam has changed a lot and is constantly changing. So I'm happy to always talk to anyone about some of the issues around it.
Are there any popular criticisms that you'd like to refute?
Well, a lot of people are saying Steam is a scam because of the fact that they had hyperinflation. So there was a very like 1,000% inflation rate. And the only way to not get sucked into the, like not to lose out, not get diluted from the inflation was to power up your Steam. And that would essentially lock your Steam in for 2 years. So if you want to power your Steam down, you essentially have to wait. You get it in 104 equal parts. So if you had $10,000 worth of Steam, you'd be able to get $100 a week for 2 years. And that would protect you against hyperinflation. You'd essentially be earning the inflation rate of whatever that is. People saw that as scammy. So actually what they did was Steam ended hyperinflation. So now it's the same inflation rate of Bitcoin. And they reduced that power up time from 2 years to only 13 weeks.
You believe Steam is going to be around for a while?
Yeah, I mean, you can call it a scam, but when you go on their site and you see the articles, I mean, you'll see dozens of comments. You'll look at the active users. I mean, not just registered users, because people can claim that's farmed accounts. Active users, you're seeing 3,000-4,000 users a day on the site. So, I mean, how can you call, like, that's a community. Those are people that are now involved in crypto that don't even come in through Bitcoin, that come in through the normal world, that now are part of crypto. These new projects are doing the guerrilla work for Bitcoin.
Support the show by buying a Bitcoin keychain at bkeychain.com. This is the classic Bitcoin keychain you've seen all over the internet. It's a substantial coin-like medallion that you'll be proud to keep with you at all times. For those who love a pun in times of division, check out the Bitcoin Fork Pen at bitcoinforks.com. Bitcoin Fork Pens are sure to get a laugh at the next Bitcoin meetup or conference. Again, that's bkeychain.com and bitcoinforks.com. We've had some excitement recently with the Bitcoin price, and I almost hate to talk about price for multiple reasons. Like, it might be irrelevant by the time this airs.
Yeah, I think what happened with China today was a lot of like fear, uncertainty, and doubt. A lot of people think that China is actually buying Bitcoin right now, which is why they did this, because they can, and they want to push the price down so they can do that.
Do you feel like that's pure speculation, or you've heard that from people who might know something?
Well, it's obviously speculation because it's not proof, but I'm pretty on the ball when it comes to what's going on in China. I'm very close to a lot of China, people in China, with BTC China and OKCoin. I speak to them pretty frequently. And, you know, when I was talking to Bobby Lee earlier, he was pretty much saying that, like, concerns are pretty much focused around, like, the loans part, like leverage and margin trading, KYC requirements, and the protection of citizens unaware of the risks of Bitcoin. And then kind of similar to what the U.S. did with FinCEN. And I mean, other than that, like, it's not like a bad thing. It's, if anything, it's like a validation of Bitcoin being worth seriously regulated, so that, you know, they take that stuff seriously.
So with the speculation that they're just trying to get the price a little lower to buy in, or buy more, do you feel like it was a similar reason back in 2013?
I don't know. It could be. The price is a lot lower. Like I said, I'm just reading like speculation from people.
Okay.
So no one really knows what's going on. And China's sleeping right now. The price has rebounded so a little bit. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
What is the price right now?
Hovering on 800.
All right. It's been an exciting couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Do you trade Bitcoin?
I pretty much buy and hold. Buying and holding is the best way to do it.
Is there anything else?
You've asked some questions that I honestly haven't been asked or said. This has been a nice interview. Try to release it soon if you can, because even with the stuff I said about China, I mean, that's pretty much what the finger on the pulse of what I think is happening. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. If anything, I'm trying to accumulate more coins over the next few days. I have a few people I have to invoice, and I'm hoping that they can pay before the price starts to go back up. just because I don't think it's I don't, you know, I think long term it's prices a lot. It's funny. It's so funny because I was talking to so Needham and company, that big company that issued that report, their price prediction at $850. I was talking to him and like he said, like he's like, I think the price really should be around $850. That's what it is. But his 2020 target, so 3 years from now, he thinks the price is going to be over $2,500 or $2,300.
I really appreciate not only you introducing my previous episode, but for taking the time today.
No problem.
Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, just follow me on Twitter and you should be good to go. It's at Charlie Shrem. BitToy.
So there you have it. I got to talk to yet another one of my early Bitcoin heroes. Hope you enjoyed the interview. I'm the BTC Game on Twitter, and you can email me at rob@thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.